You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Boyce Upholt is a journalist and essayist whose writing has appeared in The Atlantic, National Geographic, Oxford American, and Virginia Quarterly Review. His new book is The Great River, The Making and Unmaking of the Mississippi. Thank you for joining me, Boyce.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick.
The Mississippi, now that's a big subject. There we go. The Mississippi, that's a big subject. We humans are a storytelling species. We exist and live by narratives, and those narratives have certain conventions. But I think you wisely chose to rearrange those conventions and make them work with something the size and age of the Mississippi. Talk about how you decided to frame this story. And a word that occurred to me a lot, and two words that occurred to me as I read this book and read your descriptions, were circuitous and serpentine. And I thought, well, how else are you going to tell a story of something so big, so old?
Yeah, that was the big conundrum I faced when I sold this book. I keep telling people, I was surprised that a book like this didn't really exist yet, sort of like a big history of the river for a popular audience. And then once I signed the contract and started digging in, I was like, oh, it's because only someone as naive as an unpublished first-time author could think that this was like a task someone might want to take on. And so, yeah, I had to figure out how to take what wound up being like 4,000 years of history across 40% of the U.S. and put it into one book. It was some fumbling, some trial and error. I mean, at one point I thought I would organize it kind of spatially. What struck me about the river first was just going out camping and realizing that kind of between these levees that we've built along the river is this space that is so wild feeling, and I knew nothing about it. So I was like, oh, maybe I'll write about the inside of the levees and the outside of the levees and do two sections that way. But I realized kind of the work done in those two spaces was very parallel. It didn't divide out that way. At some point I remember hearing, I went to a conference and I heard a scientist ask another scientist the question, what is the purpose of a river? Which I thought was a really curious question, and wound up kind of mulling on that for months, really, and wrote down several different answers. And in some ways that became kind of like a hidden structure to the book, where I think there are a couple of different answers to what is the purpose of the river, and I sort of proceed through those. But a lot of the work, the serpentine nature of it, was just a demand of the material, where especially the early years, the years before the Louisiana Purchase, you know, there were multiple places where I could have chosen to start the story, and they all had, you know, arguments for them, arguments against them. And I think in some ways I kind of decided to use them all and kind of start the story three different times to present each of those different places where the river might begin.
You know, one thing that I noticed, well, long ago, when I first moved out of college, I moved into a little house just a little ways from Disneyland. Being out of college, I had nothing on my walls. I wanted something on my walls. I took the unused pages of an old Thomas Brothers guide, its maps, and tore them out and framed them and put them on my walls, the ones that showed the water. And I think that maps are, you know, and it was nice. And I like the feeling of maps. So talk about the import of maps and how they influenced both the development of the Mississippi and that whole region and your book. Because one of the things that I really was made clearer by your book is that, you know, when we live in a world ruled by Google, where you can, and you know, satellite mapping, where you can see everything all the time, It absolutely was not that way when we first went into the Mississippi. And the book just did a wonderful job of making it clear how confusing that whole area must have been.
Yeah. I think part of it, for me, maps were one of my ways into the river. I remember when I kind of stumbled out there, wrote a profile of a canoe guide and went out camping for a couple of nights. And I remember on that trip, kind of every chance I got where my friend John, this canoe guide, did not need to look at his navigation maps, I was kind of like, would grab them from him and like pore over them and look, try and look at where we were going. And there was just so many fascinating names on those maps. Like so many, it was so clear that there were stories that all these places were named for, that how many of them are lost now, I don't know, right? Like they're just these hints that something interesting happened and may or may not be recorded in anything besides an alluring name. And then something else that struck me early on and helped me kind of fall in love with the river is, to your point, that the world seems so accessible through Google Maps today. My first experience on the river revealed the limits of that, in that I went out on a day that the river was kind of nearing flood stage and it had washed out a road and a bridge. And so the river is the Mississippi specifically is such a dynamic thing. It can, you know, rise and fall 30 feet in a normal year, I think up to 60 feet if there's a big flood. And if if a river changes that much, the whole terrain and topography around the river will change. And so Google Maps, if you pull up the satellite, it can only ever show you the Mississippi in one given moment. And so what may exist on any given day is not going to be what you see on that map. There might be back channels that open up or islands that appear or disappear. And so that I found really enticing, as this is a space that still exists, that resists even today our sort of hyper abundant knowledge and our seeming ability to, you know, capture everything with maps or any kind of information. And that is like a theme of the book in a lot of ways. I'm also, so Jorge Luis Borges is a writer I love. And there's this little snippet of a short story that he wrote in the 40s that is essentially about an empire who got a little bit too ambitious with their maps and made their maps eventually so that they were like a one-to-one scale that overlaid the entire country. And everyone's like, well, this is kind of dumb and useless, and they fade away into nothing. And that became kind of a parable to me for what's happened on the past couple of centuries on the Mississippi River as we've attempted to control it. Before the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers could control it, we needed people to come and map it and map the entire watershed. And so there's this been long process of trying to understand everything we could about the river and capture it in these things like maps. But I think that we only, as I learned with that Google Maps at the beginning, it's we can only get so far, and that's part of the beauty of this river is how it stays outside of our control and even our ability to fully know it.
It also extends beyond, I think, what most of us understand as a river. We think of a river as a flowing body of water with banks on one side and the other that moves in a relatively, maybe a curvy line, but is relatively one body of water. The Mississippi is so many things in so many places, and in each, and it's only those things in those places for a small amount of time. And that's one of the things you write really beautifully about in this book is on the ground, the Mississippi is like everything.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that was one of the, as we were trying to figure out what title to slap on this thing, my editor and I discussed the possibility of like talking about the watershed rather than just the river. And that is one of the insights I've had. My Mississippi River time has always been on what's called the Lower Mississippi River, so down here in the South, which kind of after most of the big rivers come in, or down, I'm in New Orleans now, which is after all of the big rivers come in. And to me, so I'm biased maybe, but I've always felt like what makes the Mississippi is that it pulls these threads from all of these different places. And so, you know, I think the Missouri River, Upper Missouri River in Montana, is just as much the Mississippi as the Mississippi, the so-called Mississippi in Minneapolis. In some ways, potentially, could be more so because it's the longer river going up to Missouri. And so that was something that was really important to me to capture was, yeah, the way all these things come together. And it meant a lot to me too, living on a river that brought so much together. I can remember back in 2017, I did this long canoe trip down the river, and then not long afterwards was in Colorado for a wedding and wound up going backpacking with a friend in the Rockies. And we were hiking down the mountain in the morning, and there was kind of this new, it was the snow had melted overnight, and there was a creek at our feet that hadn't existed the day before. And I was like, oh wow, this water is going to wind up pouring into the actual Mississippi River, you know, 30 miles from where I live right now. So I'm about to fly home, and this water is going to kind of follow the same journey over a much longer length of time. And it made me really feel at home on the continent in an interesting way. And so that was something I very much wanted to capture. So I'm glad it came through.
Now, how long have you lived? Have you spent your entire life there?
I have not. No, I grew up in Connecticut, in suburban Connecticut, and really didn't think, you know, obviously we learned about the Mississippi at some point in middle school or high school, but I have no memory of what was said about it. And yeah, I can remember at one point, years after college, meeting someone. I think he had a Mississippi license on his car because his dad taught at Ole Miss or something. And even the word Mississippi, I don't know, it was like so exotic to me, and had the state itself had connotations of civil rights and all this problematic past. And so I wound up moving to Mississippi in 2009 for a job with a nonprofit, kind of mid-20s years. I knew I wanted to write, but didn't know how to do it. And so I was just casting around and wound up in the Mississippi Delta, which is sort of literally land that was built by the river, and built a nice life there. But being there eventually kind of forced me to turn my attention to the river. I wanted to understand the place where I lived, and to understand that place, you had to understand this river.
This book, as you pointed out, has more than one beginning, because there's more than one attempt to understand the Mississippi. Talk about one of the earliest, like, Western journalists. I think it was DeSoto who like, got within 70 miles of the headwaters of the Mississippi, or what are now called the headwaters, but aren't exactly. I love
right.
the way this book works, because it works the way life works, which is not clean.
Yes. Yeah, so that was, I think you're probably speaking of Zebulon Pike, who was sent north in the wake of the Louisiana Purchase in that same era, to sort of say, okay, well, this river's supposed to be ours now, so we better go up there and figure out where it begins, because that was actually very important for certain treaties with Britain, because the river was literally a legal matter in treaties. And so we had to figure out, where does this river start? And Pike went up there, and there were all these British fur trading companies, and he was saying, well, this is ours now. And they're like, okay, guy, whatever, we'll listen to you while you're here. And then when he left, they probably put the British flag back up, since we had very little control of the river. But yeah, I mean, I think it strikes me, they were, you know, for decades after that, almost 100 years, there continue to be debates about what actually is the headwaters. And eventually it was sort of what we know of as Itasca today. That's a modern name. There's a state park there, a Minnesota state park, and that's sort of officially the headwaters, even though the report that led to Itasca becoming a state park was like, well, actually there's some smaller waterways, but there's a bunch of them and they're all kind of spread out, and we couldn't put those in a park. So let's just, it's very arbitrary. It's very, jingoistic in this way, right? It's like we needed a great river, needed a great starting place. And so we put it there, we re-engineered it to make it look prettier. And I think, yeah, when it took me a while to get to Itasca, because I knew that history, and I was like, oh, it just doesn't, it feels so colonial almost. And then eventually I was like, well, I gotta go see the headwaters and write this book. And it's so beautiful. And it was so moving to see, like, all these families had traveled to this place that is in the middle of nowhere, like far from any city. And I was like, it's so great to me that people took the time to come here and to honor the idea that, like, a place where a river begins is a special place. But I wish that, like, we recognize that a river begins everywhere, right? Every time rain is falling, that is a river in some way. It's flowing in. I was talking to someone yesterday. He was like, this might be a little bit too, like, hippy dippy, but, like, it starts in the clouds, really, right? Like, if rivers connect so much. And so, yeah, I wish, instead of focusing on just one headwaters, we realized, like, everywhere we are, if you're in this giant 100 million square mile space that the river drains, you're on the Mississippi in one way or another.
You know, I also love too how you wrote that once we decided to make it a state park, we decided to improve it by you know, like removing all the nature. And I think this is clearly, you know, one of the themes of this book. Gosh, I want to say novel because it feels so whole and you know, compulsively readable. But talk about, you know, the improvements we did there and how that's just like, you know, like a tiny mirror shard of what we did over thousands of miles, 10,000 mistakes, maybe 10,000 successes, and you know, 100,000, who knows what the heck we did.
Right. Right. It's mind-boggling how much we've done. But yeah, specifically at Itasca, what happened was, it was basically Itasca was this lake in the middle of these pine forest in Minnesota, and the water kind of just dribbled out of its edge and formed this little creek. And it was just, I think, a little bit too, right at that point, there was this notion of like the Mississippi is America's river, right? This is where, this is Twain's river. This is the river that created American literature. And so it was this notion of a different kind of greatness beyond just like the river that ties everything together. It was the river that made America what it is. And so it had to have a scenic beginning. And so what was done, there was basically a dam built at the edge of this lake. And then there's some boulders placed on top so that the water would run over these boulders and make this like mini little rapids, which was it is very pretty. And it's much more aesthetically pleasing than just like muddy water dribbling out into a creek. And then that first bit of the channel, I think is like sort of straightened up so that there's like a consistent width and depth. So that you, right. And I've gone there. I immersed myself in that water and it was a spiritual moment for me, but it was also, you know, this awareness of it's a funny improvement. It's one of the few improvements we've made for the sake of aesthetics on the Mississippi River, but also very symbolic. By the time those improvements were made in the 1930s, for 50 years already, the mouth of the river there'd been jetties down there to like make them straighter and faster so that they would kind of keep their own channel open for big ocean going freighters. And so it allowed me to say in the book at that point, literally from the head to the mouth of the river had been engineered. And there's, yeah, so much else along its course at that point, from levees to dikes to dams to flood control, like the control structures they call them. And so it's part of reporting this book was trying to travel around and see as much of this engineering as possible. And it remains hard for me to like think of them as being a single object, but they're like a hyper object in some way. They come together to make something entirely new.
That's a really fascinating insight to think of the entirety of the human additions to the Mississippi as one giant machine. And that's one of the things that comes out of this book is we've built the world's largest Rube Goldberg device along the edge of an absolutely uncontrollable river with the idea we are going to control it.
Right. Well, and one thing I'm always cautious of like the machine metaphor for the Mississippi or any river, my love and knowledge of the Mississippi River, it's both true. It's absolutely true that we've made this Rube Goldberg machine. But I think what I never want to emphasize it too heavily, because until I went out and started spending time on the Mississippi River, I had such a mistaken notion of it because of that idea of like, I just imagined it's got to be just, you know, people always said, why would you ever want to see that river? It's just a big concrete funnel and it's filled with pollution. And it is so controlled, but it is like at the same time, especially here in the South, especially sort of from Memphis to Vicksburg, Mississippi, hundreds of miles of river where you'll see towboats, you'll see grain silos, but other than that, you're going to see giant forests and sandbars and coyotes. If you're lucky, you might see a black bear. It is this like secret wilderness at the heart of our continent. At the same time, it is this epic machine.
When you talk about beginnings, you take us back to the beginning before the beginning with the civilizations that existed along the Mississippi before we brought our so-called civilization here. And it was just amazing to think about it and see those structures in our mind. And I think you did a wonderful job of creating a narrative and descriptions of things that I had never, ever considered would be in America. And I have to admit, yes, I did think a few times, it's aliens.
Definitely come up before. So.
Talk about Cahokia and just the amazing earthenworks that you know, were the first attempt to, you know, integrate the river into human civilization, and in many ways, far more successful.
Yeah. Yeah. So the often called mounds, Indian mounds, I have taken to using the phrase earthworks through some reading some indigenous scholars that sort of prefer that term, and that mound sounds so like, you know, earthworks talks about like it is of the earth, and it was like true work to build these. And so they take many different forms along, and they're all over the continent, but they're particularly dominant along rivers, and particularly the Mississippi watershed. Some of the more famous earthworks are like up in Minnesota. They take the form of serpents and animals and some sorts of spiritual creatures. But what I think of as sort of the original earthworks that first started down here in Louisiana thousands and thousands of years ago. And they're a bit simpler. They're just kind of almost like earthen pyramids, and then often they have a plateau on the top, so they're like a platform. They almost look like a stage. But at a site called Watson Break, and I'm not going to give the precise date because there's so many dates in this book that I've lost them myself, but I think at least thousands of years ago, at the site called Watson Break, a number of these mounds were built or earthworks were built in an arrangement, very sort of like thoughtfully placed as this complex site that clearly has spiritual significance. And then from there, more great earthworks were built through the centuries and millennia. Cahokia, a site across the river from St. Louis, being the largest mounds ever constructed, or you could say yet constructed is one way I think about it. Same thing. Like when I moved to Mississippi, I saw these Indian mounds. I didn't think much of them until I started working on this book. And then as I dug into sort of this epic tale of all of the civilizations or all of the cultures that preceded what we know today on this continent, it just strikes me as this like lost history. And I think it's getting covered more and more, fortunately. But it opens up this just rich picture of what the river used to be, of people who understood that the river was chaotic and difficult, but also understood that in that chaos and difficulty, there was so much life. Like these floods dump really rich soils that allow you to farm, and the sort of messy nature of the river built the delta here where I live in Louisiana, which is one of the most sort of, if you want to eat well, it's a very good place to eat well because there's so much sea life. And so I mean, it's impossible to know exactly what the people who made these earthworks meant by them, but they strike me as sort of symbolizing the importance of this river in the continent for so many cultures for so long.
Could you talk about what you call three worlds theory?
Yeah. So the three worlds theory is something that lives on today in a lot of indigenous cosmologies here in the Southeast, or people that lived in the Southeast and removed to Oklahoma and quote Indian country. And the idea there is there's essentially that the world that we see and know is sort of this island that exists between an upper world, which would be sort of sky-ish. And then the upper world is a more orderly world where you think about how astronomy is filled with sort of predictable phenomena, and the stars rotate in a complex but very predictable swirl. And then you've got the lower world, which is like watery, ocean-based, and is much more chaotic. You think of hurricanes coming in off the Gulf of Mexico. And the earthworks seems to me like it's pretty likely that they have a lot to do, like that they're related to this three worlds theory. There are a lot of creation stories in the Southeast that involve an earth diver. So sometimes a muskrat, sometimes a crawfish, some sort of creature is instructed to go down. Like the world begins just as the chaos of water, and someone's instructed to go down to the bottom and get some mud from the bottom of that water and build up the middle world, which is obviously very akin to the action it would require to build an earthwork. And so there's this sense that like building these earthworks is potentially a performance, a recreation of the world, a resetting, potentially in a moment of crisis, it might make sense to go and build one of these things as a way of sort of resetting and finding safety and space again amid the chaos of this river space.
One of the things you say that I had never thought of, which is most of this book, it's really interesting and exciting. You describe this as the settlement where the American West began, and that the Mississippi River was a wilder than the Wild West. And that makes perfect sense as you describe it. Could you talk about discovering that story and corralling the story so that you could actually tell it? Because the story itself seems pretty wild and not easily put down in words, but you put it down in words that we cannot stop reading.
Thank you. I think that I blame Mark Twain a little bit for this. He's a very wise man. I was just remarking to someone how so many of his thoughts about the river hold up centuries later. But because Twain is sort of like the river guy, when people think of the Mississippi River today, I think we think of his era. We think of steamboats, or, you know, Huck Finn was actually set decades earlier. But there's just a few images that sort of dominate what the river came to be. And those are, you know, halfway through the American story, essentially. And so there were several decades after the Louisiana Purchase when technically the U.S. was sort of the empire in charge of the Mississippi River. But we were still a fledgling little nation and didn't really, you know, like, there were a lot of different indigenous people that were quite powerful themselves. And the British were still kind of like, you know what, we might be able to take this back. So it for a long time, it remained a space where, yeah, there was a pretty wild culture grew up there, early on, right? As soon as farmers started pouring over the Appalachian Mountains and farming along the Ohio River, they started using the Mississippi to take their goods down market to New Orleans, but that created this kind of rip-roaring, drunken sailor culture all along the Mississippi River that in some ways, I think, you're right, like Thomas Jefferson it was always a myth, but he had this dream of like, we're going to be a nation of like very polite democratic farmers all over. And he needed the Mississippi River to get that done. And then he got the Mississippi River and it was so much emptiness and wildness that I think it like birthed this, you combine with the violence that was necessary to sort of grab that land from indigenous people, put that in with a lot of empty space. And you get out this swirl of this brawling American image that I think very much persists today. So like, yeah, it, the Wild West image, I think, was born on the Mississippi.
One of my favorite scenes in this book is a scene where I think it's DeSoto's coming down the river in his boats, and he encounters one of these Indian cultures, and they are unstoppable warriors, and they're the so-called civilized Europeans are just not equipped to deal with them. And I think that does a great job of painting a picture of, you know, arriving in a continent and thinking, well, we can just run this over at our own pace, but then finding out not quite.
Right. Yeah. So Soto and his man, well, Soto was dead by then, but yeah, Soto arrived in the mid-16th century, kind of hoping to find some gold and never did, and went on this long, years-long path of destruction, warfare that didn't help continent at all, but also he lost half of his men, and then he died and was sunk in the river. And so eventually the remaining half of his army was like, we got to get out of here. And so they were trying to build, they camped out on the Mississippi River and were trying to build these rafts. And on their way out, they were basically escorted off the continent by this very capable Navy of a very powerful chief who lived here along the lower Mississippi River. And when I read the descriptions that are left from the notes of those survivors of that quote expedition, I'm struck by like, clearly here are people that knew this river intimately, that knew how to paddle on it, that knew how to work with its flow. And then the Soto and his men just were so lost in a place that was so different than anything they'd ever seen.
And you tell the story of a number of great characters. Tell us about Mike Fink.
Yeah. So Mike Fink, as I was saying, the idea of the Wild West was born on the Mississippi River, maybe on the Ohio River, because I think Mike Fink is sort of the idea of the Wild West embodied in one man. He started as sort of this scout, I guess they called it. And so he was living in the upper Ohio watershed, and his job was to sort of keep an eye on the indigenous people and make sure they weren't getting too close to the new American settlements. And then eventually after some treaties were signed, that job, you know, there's no point in that. So Mike Fink became what was known as a boatman. He had spent too long kind of sleeping in the woods, and so wasn't going to go back to society. And so the best thing he could do is go work on these boats that were going up and down the Mississippi River. And he is just this, I mean, he was supposed to be this incredible marksman. He's just like very much a tall tale figure about all these fights and boasts and shootings, and becomes like embodied everything that a boatman might want to be. And again, I think that eventually he embodied sort of what Andrew Jackson wanted to be later, this president that brought so much violence to this region. And then that's where I say, like, I think Mike Fink people today have never heard of him, for the most part. But I think when I look around at certain parts of American culture that I am not in love with, some hyper masculine aggressiveness, I think a lot of it started with Mike Fink.
And also, you do a great job, and you were referring to this earlier, of describing the Louisiana Purchase. I mean, it just seems what a mind-bogglingly good idea it was at the time, and also how it's one of those things where be careful what you wish for, you might get it. So talk about the Louisiana Purchase and you know, the effect it had on both America and how central, literally central to America, the Mississippi River became.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, I mentioned Jefferson earlier and had this vision of like, he thought the best form of democracy required farmers, and required farmers who owned their own land and lived on their own land were going to be, you know, didn't have to depend on someone else for their wages, weren't in debt to anyone. And to make that, there wasn't enough space on the east side of the Appalachian Mountains in the original colonies to make that work for very long. And so, he had to look west, and that eventually meant, well, like, he got this shot. Basically, he thought he was going to go get New Orleans, just so at the very least, the farmers that were on the eastern half of the watershed wouldn't kind of be harassed by Spanish authorities in New Orleans. They could get their goods to market with no problem. And then it turned out that, it wasn't Spanish anymore. It very briefly was back in French hands. And then the French had lost to a rebellion of enslaved laborers in Haiti, and their whole plans for what to do with Louisiana were kind of up in the air at that point. So they're like, let's just get rid of this thing. Nobody's been able to deal with Louisiana in any good capacity. So we'll give it to you, Jefferson, at a pretty cut rate price. And then that just vastly expanded the size of the United States of America, right? That's in many ways, I mean, the first step towards manifest destiny were these farmers that were just coming down the Ohio River. But once you had the Western watershed, that really changed the scope of what we were envisioning as a country. But in that moment, it was, you know, people, there were still stories of sort of like monsters and dragons out there. Very few white people had any picture of what was out there, except for some of the French hunters that had been going out there to collect skins.
We all associate the steamboat with the Mississippi, but in another story that I absolutely love, Henry Shreve, what an amazing fellow he was, and what he accomplished was also amazing. One thing I like is you do a great job in this book of presenting the mixed story triumphs that are somewhat, self-immolating, and maybe in the long run, not necessarily as triumphant as they felt at the time.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the big muddy river like this, that whatever you do, there's going to be some unintended consequences. And so we keep plugging forward, but everything we've built, that's what the subtitle there, the making and unmaking. Some people are like, oh, when does the unmaking start? And I was like, well, we've been making the Mississippi River for several centuries, but everything we do to make it is the unmaking of the original river that preceded us.
You know, too, as a reader, one of the things I really loved was to find out this whole history of the Army Corps of Engineers. I mean, they're out actually right by where I live in Santa Cruz trying to fix a levee that broke during the storms a couple of years ago. And I never knew their whole history, which is just fascinating. This must have been really fun for you to dig into.
It was fun. I mean, interestingly, it was, I feel like the middle section of the book I think of it as, it's the most, I mean, we talked before about the serpentine nature of this book, and in the middle section of the book, I tried to not curve at all. I'm sort of like, this is the American section, and Americans are very progress committed. We like to do things, you know, like we just keep moving forward. And it made sense. So basically this section tells 200 years of like how the river has been changed. It's not precisely, whereas like every chapter, I kind of like go forward for a bit and I have to back up to catch up to the new topic. But, it was fun, but it also, I mean, my editor, when I turned in the initial draft, was like, this section is this is great. And it surprised me because it's not the story that drew me to the river. Like, I wanted to write this book because I had fallen in love with being on the river. And like, I knew I needed to understand the engineering, but I've never entranced by the stories of, like, I don't like great men history. I don't really like, I'm not someone who's going to read a president's biography. And so there's a very great book called Rising Tide that covers some of the same history. And I found it very gripping, but it wasn't, you know, I wouldn't have ever tried to conceive of a book that is just like, let me tell the tale of these engineers, but they are such colorful figures. And they had such drama, petty drama, I think, but like, there was so much drama in like so much ego, so much narrative there, I'm glad that people really, that the middle section came together, because if it hadn't been such compelling stuff, it might've been very hard for me as someone who like sort of wasn't naturally drawn to that material.
Well, also it chronicles, in a sense, as you noted earlier, the unmaking of the actual Mississippi in the way that it would normally have flowed through the landscape, and the remaking of it in a way that is convenient to us, but which is prone and extremely vulnerable. The Mississippi flowed the way it flowed from the beginning because that was the way it was meant to flow, and that was what the landscape allowed. And as powerful as humans are, we're not that powerful. We cannot outwit the floodplains. They are called the floodplains for a reason.
They are called the floodplains for a reason. Yeah, and as someone who lives in the Southern River, and as we get more rain due to climate change, it's sort of like, it's never that surprising the places that are going to pool with water. There were places that water always wound up. So
now, you also write about, you know, the cotton plantations and the plantation years. I think you do that really well. And I also love that you bring in the blues and the music and do that really well. Talk about like pulling together these really disparate strands of narrative and putting them into, you know, a really great story. I mean, from the engineers to the musicians, that's a big transition, but it feels really natural against the lands, the backdrop of the Mississippi, which enables all things human and many of the bad things too.
Yes. Yeah, maybe I'm lucky. So I, like, when I wound up in the South, I'm in New Orleans now, but I lived for 9 years in the region known as the Mississippi Delta. So that's like that sort of the place where the blues was born, and it is the Cotton Kingdom. It plays all these epic roles in American history. And so living there for 9 years, I just got to know a lot of those stories well. I mean, that's where I began my career as a writer, and so dealt with all these materials in many different ways. But I think, I mean, like, I don't know. I'm still like, I don't try to articulate craft wise what I was trying to do in this book. And I was mostly just stumbling through, but I think naturally, instinctually, I am always looking for vivid details, and vivid details that make this history feel material, that may like the river obviously is the through line. And the more I can make the river come alive in each era, the better. And so that's the connection to me between engineers in the Cotton Kingdom and the bluesmen. These were all, I mean, I basically was just trying to get the story of everyone that touched the river and that touched the river's mud, because that's part of the river too. And that, like, the engineers were building levees so that the cotton plantations could exist. And then the men that were building those levees and the men that were working on those cotton plantations were the same men who invented this music called the blues. And so it eventually occurred to me that, you know, I'm very reliant, particularly for the stories of these black laborers who built the levees, who worked on the farms, sort of very reliant on secondhand stories, on sort of the letters that white people saved describing their interactions with these laborers because their own lives were not as directly recorded. But the blues music, I was like, oh, here's one way that I can hear these voices directly. And they don't often comment on the landscape, but there are little pieces that you can pick up. And I felt like that was something important to include. Like if this music was born in this landscape, and it's such a famous music, and it clearly carries such an emotional weight, then we need to unpack kind of what that tells us about the landscape on the river too.
You were talking about the ways that the river touched America. And for me, one of the things I've detailed I loved was the idea of the river panoramas. Mm. Explain what those were and how that took the Mississippi, recreated the Mississippi away from the Mississippi.
Yeah, so this was a big thing also in the 1840s, kind of near the height of the steamboat era. There had been ideas of panoramic art before in various forms, but eventually people kind of stumbled on this idea of like, okay, if we make a really, really long horizontal painting on this really long scroll, and then we put some like spools up here, we can roll it along and kind of give the illusion that you're sitting on a steamboat watching the river go past. And so this guy named John Danvard was the first to kind of think of this on the Mississippi, and he spent years kind of traveling the river, collecting sketches before making his painting. And then it was this really big hit, first in Louisville, Kentucky, which was a big town for the boatmen. And then from there, it was so well-received enough that it managed to kind of leap over to Boston and New York, and eventually went to London. And to me, it was a really telling moment. I'm always struck. I mean, Henry David Thoreau saw it, and he wrote about it in Walking, which is, I think, I would say his most famous essay. And he uses it in this way that we don't typically think of Thoreau, where he's essentially endorsing Manifest Destiny and saying like, yes, our country is this great country going west. And he got that insight by looking at this panorama of the Mississippi and seeing how there's this like yet to be conquered land that our empire is going towards. And then Longfellow also saw it while he was working on Evangeline, which is a poem set down here in Louisiana. And he was like, great, I needed to understand this landscape, and now I don't have to go bother seeing it. And it's very revealing to me. It feels like this moment where it's almost like the Mississippi River jumped the shark, to use a more modern metaphor, where like people, for a while, it had been something that so many Americans actually experienced, but then it became more and more famous. And it sort of went from being a thing that people interacted with to being just a thing that people thought about. And so the fact that Longfellow was able to do multiple poems about Mississippi River country without ever going out there kind of signals this change where it's becoming more famous, but in a way it's disappearing. It's becoming less important to the actual day-to-day life of America.
The science fiction writer William Gibson once said that the future has arrived, but it's just not evenly distributed.
Yep.
I think this book is a absolutely, perfect demonstration of how history rolls out and how civilization rolls out, which is to say, unevenly. And one of the things that I loved was the idea of, you brought in, of course, Lincoln. So talk about, bringing Lincoln into your narrative. And I'm just thinking, wow, this is a book that features Lincoln, Twain. You've got Black Hawk. This is like, in a sense, the Mississippi River, and especially the Delta, is like, the place into which all of America drains.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, and Lincoln specifically sort of spanned in one lifetime, saw so many eras of the modern river. And that's part of why, I mean, I think he only appears in one paragraph, but multiple people have like remembered that paragraph in a way I don't know what that tells me, but yeah, Lincoln, he started off as a farm boy in Indiana, I think, somewhere out in the Corn Belt. And so he was one of these sort of the rowdiest of the boatmen had kind of faded away, and it became more young men taking their crops to market. And Lincoln was one of those young men. And he later, I don't think this is in the book, but he used it in some of his myth making later and kind of said, seeing slavery on those trips is part of what made me so opposed to slavery. And then before he became as he was starting to be a politician, he was also a lawyer and wound up representing railroad company. So eventually, as steamboats were being sort of displaced by the expansion of railroad, it was sort of the same technology driving forward, right? Like steam engines were pretty good at getting people around on rivers, but when you put them on rail tracks, all of a sudden you don't have to care about topography. You don't have to, you can literally punch a hole through a mountain and go that way instead of worrying about the flow of a river. And so sort of that was the moment when America was beginning to be like, well, we don't really need this river anymore because we have railroads. And so this former farm boy who took so much pride in being sort of a riverman then was representing the group that was saying like, let's build this bridge. We don't care if this bridge is going to get in the way of steamboat traffic. It's time for us to look westward and move on.
As a fan of 1980s synthesizer music, one of my favorite bands was started by a refugee from Depeche Mode who thought that the recently invented MIDI interface, a musical instrument digital interface, was not accurate in a form, and he liked the old school control voltages to trigger his mini sequencers, and so he founded the band Yazoo, which I love their music, but I could not have not until this reading this book found out where the name came from and why it is so darned important to explain where Yazoo came from, where it is, and what it is.
Yeah, so the Yazoo River is the biggest tributary in the Mississippi Delta, right? So there's all this floodplain on the Mississippi River, but most of it actually is on the western side of the river, and the Mississippi Delta is the one eastern patch of floodplain. And again, that's the place where I live. That's the place where the blues was born. And the Yazoo River is the river that drains all the water that falls there and comes into the Mississippi. And so it's always been, I mean, there may be more significance for that name Yazoo than I can share here, because I think some hydrologists, there's a certain class of river that are known as Yazoo rivers that kind of go parallel to the main river. I don't know the precise definition. It has something to do with sort of the geological past of the Yazoo River and how it used to be, like any river down there in those floodplains used to be, the Mississippi flowed there at some point. So the Yazoo is kind of a former Mississippi channel. I mean, it's just, there used to be a legend that Yazoo meant river of death, which is not true so far as I can tell. It's just the name of the people that once lived along the river. But the Yazoo is this just legendary river tributary in that it was like the Mississippi Delta is such a storied place, and that it was the center of so many dreams of farming empires. And it took so long for us to make that farming empire happen, and it took so much slavery and violence to make it happen, that River of Death in some ways is suitable, I think.
You take us up to the modern day, and I just love your description. Recently, what happened was the rise of the refineries with the coming of the railroads, and you describe the landscape as like Mordor with these giant flames coming out. Talk about the import of that and how that has changed the character, and also the incredible danger it created with in terms of the pollution. I mean, you spent a while talking about this, and it's kind of terrifying.
It is fairly terrifying, yeah. And strangely, the stretch of river from Baton Rouge to New Orleans is sort of the stretch I've canoed the most, in part because after I moved down here, my friend, the canoe guide, would occasionally, clients would want to see it. And then he'd be like, well, I need someone else to help man this canoe. Why don't you come along? And so that Mordor description specifically was, we took some photographers out. They wanted to take photos of the plants from the river. And so we would like be paddling upstream at dusk against the current, going underneath these like pipelines. And yeah, seeing, it's just like the off gas flaring from chemical plants and oil refineries. So it is a very dystopian landscape, although I should say, like, I feel like that is before I got to travel in that stretch of river on the land side. There are, it's very familiar to people down in here in Louisiana. We call it Cancer Alley or Death Alley even now, because the huge number of industrial facilities is so poisonous to residents. And so it's easier to picture it as only that, but there are some really beautiful stretches in there. And I think it's important to remember that, right? Like all the places that beauty remains. But yeah, basically the history is all these plants are built on the sites of former sugar plantations, because as the sugar economy kind of went bust, At the same time, the oil economy was rising. And so there was a lot of cheap land that was protected by the levee and a good site to build these factories and facilities. But then between all the sugar plantations, there would be these much smaller villages with black residents. It'd be like the little bits of land that even before slavery ended, that people would be living in. They managed to keep control of some of that land, and no industrial facilities interested in buying up these tiny little slivers of land. And so they remain as residential areas squeezed between all these plants. And so it's created a real crisis for people where it is, you know, not a safe place to live, but there are varied opinions in those communities. There are some people that are ready to pick up and move, but you know, they can't sell their house for enough to be able to buy anywhere else, because who wants to buy a house that's in that condition? But then you have other people in those communities and say, I don't ever want to leave here. And so are really fighting the good fight and trying to stop more facilities from coming in.
One of the many characters that you describe is Will Dockery. And I love your attention to the characters along that, you know, you meet essentially along this history of the river. Talk about not just Will, but just the kind of succession of men. And I think they are by and large men who, in a sense, helped to build the river, and then whose names have, to a certain extent, disappear from our history. William Eads, Dockery. These are really great stories that you tell.
Yeah. I mean, Dockery was a convenient one because he allowed me to bridge those stories we're talking about before from the cotton plantation to the bluesman, because it was on Dockery's plantation that kind of one of the most famous and influential of bluesmen first honed his craft. But then Will Dockery was great because he sort of very much represented a whole generation of wealthy white men and sort of what they aimed to do. He was one of the more successful. So Dockery moved into the Mississippi Delta in 1888 with some money from his family. He was just going to open up a store, and then that sort of, he bought some sawmills, and then he bought some land, and then he bought more. Eventually he bought this giant sprawling plantation of land, and he was like a feudal lord, right? His plantation had its own scrip. So you didn't use U.S. dollars. You used the plantation scrip to buy things, which is like, okay, we're not, this is no longer Jefferson's Empire of Liberty where we have all these small landowners. This is back to feudalism very much so. But yeah, I mean, it was, I don't know. It's again, one of these things, this section of this book was hard for me to figure out what to do. And it was always helpful to find characters like Eads, like Shreve, like Dockery that had so much color, because that could help me kind of drag the story, not even drag the story forward, but like hurry the story forward, because they were such fascinating people. I think I was always slightly frustrated though, because to your point, those names are lost to a lot of people. Dockery is famous to blues fans, but maybe no one else. But you know, it had to be these white guys whose story I told. There's one section towards the end of the book where I kind of try and give everyone else their brief space, particularly down here in the Delta. Just like, there's all the stories that I don't get to tell, like the bluesmen, or like all these communities that popped up in the wetlands here in the Delta, runaway slave communities, or just there were a lot of immigrant communities coming in and fishing in the Delta, and just fascinating cultures. But because they, you know, like their stories are not as well preserved, I wasn't going to be capable of putting them at the center of the narrative. But in some ways, I think those are the people that deserve to be at the center of the narrative, because I think they had a maybe healthier relationship with the river, but at least a more intimate relationship with the river.
The new book by Boyce Upholt is The Great River. Thank you for joining me, Boyce.
Thanks so much, Rick. This was wonderful.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.